Okay, this hour we're going to take your calls with Steve Silberman as we talk about NeuroTribes right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back this hour with Steve Silberman with his book, NeuroTribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, which I'm going to ask you about in a minute here, Steve, in terms of what that means, that subheading. Are we as a country doing enough for autistic families and children?
Not at all. And that is one of the main points of my book, is that, you know, we are investing millions and millions of dollars into autism research. So that sounds good. You know, it sounds like we're doing what we should be doing. We're looking for the causes of autism. But the problem is that the causes of autism are turning out to be extremely complex. For instance, when I started writing about autism, a lot of parents were talking about the autism gene. Well, there is no autism gene. It turns out that autism is caused by at least 1,000 candidate genes, and that each autistic person is probably genetically quite unique. And then there are environmental factors added on to that. And so, you know, we're sort of going on these big ticket fishing expeditions in genetic databases and also looking at a kind of ever-lengthening list of potential environmental risk factors. Meanwhile, families are hung out to dry. When their kids age at what's called aging out of services, like when they graduate from high school, there's virtually nothing in place to help them transition into the workplace if they're capable of working. Families often have to, you know, the mom has to quit her job so that she can become the case manager for the kid. Families often have to sue their local school boards for the kid's right to get an education. So, you know, at the same time that you see these headlines for these, you know, $50 million, you know, genetic study in the Beijing Genomics Institute or whatever. So it sounds like, oh yes, we're very serious about autism. Actually, families are struggling every day. And that's what I hear most from parents, is that, you know, even just to get a kid a diagnosis, often there's like, a long waiting list. It could be a year even to get the kid clinically evaluated. And, you know, that is valuable time when the kid's brain is developing. And if they're on a waiting list for a year just to get the diagnosis, you know, it's not good. And so really what my book argues for is that, you know, it's great that we're spending all this money on these big ticket, you know, science projects. Sure. It's like a full employment plan, you know, for geneticists. But meanwhile, the families of autistic kids and the autistic people themselves who become adults and there's nothing for them, they don't have access to health care. You know, basically we're just leaving them we're hanging them out to dry. And that's one of the main arguments of my book, is that we should really focus as a society on providing services for autistic people and their families.
Steve, when they brain scan people who are autistic, does it show up in a region in the brain where they can see that something is going on there?
Well, you know, that's one of those things that, like, every 6 months there's a headline, you know, fMRI may prove to be key to diagnosing autism. And yet, you know, it's like they keep finding, like, contradictory signs. So there is no biomarker for autism. There's no brain scan or blood test or anything that you can do to diagnose autism. Autism is a set of behaviors that is diagnosed with clinical observation. In other words, good old, you know, eyes on from somebody with a lot of clinical experience can diagnose autism. And there are, you know, standardized tests that you can administer, and, you know, if the kid does this and that, then it means that the kid is probably autistic. But there's no biomarker, so you can't just scan a brain and figure out if the kid is autistic.
Not proponent of mood-altering prescription drugs or anything like that, but do they prescribe any drugs to people who are autistic?
There are a couple of drugs that are officially approved. One of them, Risperdal, which is it's FDA approved for autism. It's an antipsychotic that was, you know, probably developed for adult schizophrenics. But there are a lot of off-label uses for various drugs for autism. The truth of the matter is I actually sat in on a, I don't want to say secret, but it was like a closed door meeting of psychiatrists at the APA who were talking about what drugs they prescribe for autism. And I got to tell you, there it's like shots in the dark. Like, you know, they give a kid this. If the side effects become too much, then they give the kid something else. And, you know, nothing really works. So there are some things that, you know, can cut down on a kid if the kid has trouble with violent behavior. You know, some drugs make the kids calmer. And I'm not judgmental about that. You know, parents have to do whatever they have to do, and autistic people, and autistic people themselves sometimes choose to medicate themselves. And that's, you know, perfectly, they have every right to do so. But really, there's no, like, you know, silver bullet or whatever to treat the core symptoms of autism. And the drugs that they use are really, it's like, you know, off-label uses and, you know, trying to find something that works.
Let's take some calls here for you, Stephen. People calling from all over the world here. Let's go to Syracuse, New York to get things started. Stephen, you're on with Stephen. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, Stephen. Thank you so much for your book. I put it on my Amazon wish list. I haven't got money to get it right now. Hey, guess what? I'm an autistic. And I identify with Temple Grandin very much. That's my favorite movie. When I heard Diane Hennessy Powell, I woke up one morning talking about autism and ESP. I fell in love with that gal, with her voice and the way she talked.
That's great.
I was never labeled autistic. I just sort of was in a happy family, and I went south big time when I told my mother with all kinds of excitement that I identified with the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and she said, he's evil, and that popped my balloon, and I never got labeled anything until I was in the Air Force, and I read Atlas Shrugged while I was over in Spain in the Air Force, and then that got me really excited, because Ayn Rand's my favorite person in the whole world in history, along with Jesus, and I got labeled mentally ill then, still labeled mentally ill, but finally I got a second opinion from I love Peter Bregan.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Great guy.
So I was labeled mentally ill because I got excited about Atlas Shrugged over in Spain, and I got put in a hospital in Torrejon Air Base, and then I got aerovac from there through some Rhein Main Hospital in Germany. I went in Ohio, Dayton Air Force Base. Then I went to Canandaigua in April of 1967. I've been labeled mentally ill ever since. Mostly bipolar. The most accurate is atypical bipolar, because I never did drugs. I never slept around. And I formed my mind around one question that really got me. It's quoted in Canandaigua Man Heeds Calling to Help Others. And it's where is St. Thomas Aquinas, who no doubt was autistic too? His question was, what is God? My question is quoted in this 800-word article at the time Princess Diana died, was, how would God bring a heavenly world about? And that is the truth. So I can help out so much autistic people. I can help out the bipolars, because I understand that I'm labeled bipolar. I know that autism is being in a dream state. And you're born with a dream. You're supposed to do great things. I think it's part of loving God's plan. And So I think it's time I get known, and I'm trying my best.
Good for you, Stephen. How old are you, Stephen?
I'm 71, getting younger every day, and I want to give a shout-out to somebody who's a runner, because I'm a runner, too. My father was a captain of Yale track team. He could have been in the Olympics. He could broad jump 24'1". I'd like to give a shout out to Mikey Brannigan. He was an autistic that was running at 10 months old. He'd run into walls. He wouldn't put his hands out. Now, Mikey Brannigan. has run 2 miles in high school in 8 minutes and 42 seconds.
Wow.
He's number one ranked in the country.
Super.
And I want to get known and have listen to people and help people. If I can help so much, it's going to be astounding.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stephen, you're well known now, my friend. So you keep listening and check in every once in a while. That was a nice call there, Steve.
That's great. Thank you.
And autistic people, do they have higher IQs than people who aren't autistic?
Well, here's the thing. IQ is very, very difficult to measure in autistic people because IQ tests are designed for non-autistic people. What autistic people call neurotypicals, which is, you know, people like me, who, you know, I'm not autistic. But so IQ is very difficult to measure, and it's often underestimated in autistic people, particularly if they have problems with language. So it's actually still, you know, the jury is still out whether or not you can even accurately measure IQ in an autistic person.
Huh.
Really, the best way to do it is through nonverbal means, actually. There are nonverbal equivalents of IQ tests.
Well, I found Stephen to be pretty eloquent, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, oh, absolutely. That is not uncommon at all in autism. Some of the most eloquent people you could ever hear are autistic, and yet others can't speak, you know, but
yeah,
they might be eloquent when using a keyboard. So the thing about autistic people is that it's so easy to underestimate what's going on inside them, but the advent of the internet allowed many autistic people who, you know, had been habitually underestimated their whole lives to really express themselves and start talking to each other. And that has been really a boon for autistic people with the development of the internet. Because if you're sitting at a keyboard, you know, if you're sitting at a keyboard, you don't have to process like the facial expressions, the body language, the tone of voice, all the stuff that is very, very difficult for autistic people to process accurately. You can just speak your mind, you know, at your own pace. And so that's been a huge thing for autistic people, is the development of online forums and the internet.
Let's go to Walter on our Skype line in Toronto, Canada. Hi, Walter. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. I enjoyed your presentation in Toronto this weekend, and we hope we see you back next year as well.
We sure will. And thank you, by the way. I had a great time out there.
I'd like to respectfully disagree with your guest. He just said that there was no biomarkers or common denominators with people with autism. In fact, I just went on PubMed, which is the medical database of the National Institute of Health. Any of your readers can go on to that. And I typed in autism and the word oxidative stress. And I got 285 articles that show a direct connection between free radicals in the body or something called oxidative stress and a variety of psychiatric disorders. I'll just read you the title of one of them here. It says,
sure,
oxidative stress as an etiological factor and a potential treatment target for psychiatric disorders, part two, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and autism. So we're going
yes,
back
but
to
oxidative stress is not a biomarker. It's a theory. It's a theory that autism is caused by oxidative stress. And in fact, I just read a paper about 48 hours ago that looked at oxidative stress and a chemical in the brain called glutathione, which a lot of people have theorized is different in the brains of autistic people. And in fact, that study showed that it was not different in autistic people, which holds the oxidative stress hypothesis in question. So a biomarker is something that you can point to and say, if they have this measurable thing in the brain, then they have autism. And there is no biomarker for autism. That doesn't mean, you know, that there's nothing biological going on in autism, but it does mean that there is, as yet, no clinical test that people can take to diagnose autism.
Steve, in your opinion, autism caused by a virus, something that has happened in the brain, maybe a deformity when they were born, if you had to pinpoint something, what would you think it might be from?
It's some interplay between genetics and the environment. And by the environment, I don't mean necessarily like air pollution. I mean like even the environment in the womb. So, you know, there's a theory that high levels of testosterone in the womb might trigger autism in genetically susceptible children. That's one plausible theory. Another plausible theory, I mean, there are a million theories. Believe me, autism has been a fountain of, you know, promising theories for 70 years, most of which turned out to be wrong. But another promising theory that I think may be true is that older fathers are carrying more mutations in their sperm than younger fathers, and people are waiting longer to get married and have kids now. So it could be that something that is contributing to some small rise in autism has to do with the fact that people are waiting until they're older to have kids. But, you know, there are so many theories about different risk factors for autism that a science writer at Forbes named Emily Willingham wrote a blog post called "This Just In, Being Alive Linked to Autism." And, you know, she, as the mother of an autistic kid, she just got tired of reading, you know, this week's story that was the cause du jour of autism. So I know that everyone is fascinated with the notion of what causes autism, but I actually think that in a way it's been like this, you know, completely fascinating distraction that society has been spent the last 10 years arguing about, you know, is it vaccines? Is it not vaccines? Is it mercury? Is it not mercury? You know, is it air pollution? Is it not air pollution? And, you know, all that time, every other conversation, like what should we do for families to make their lives more secure so parents don't have to worry that if they die, their autistic kids will be totally left alone in the world without somebody to advocate for their needs. I think those are the kinds of questions that we should be giving more attention to rather than arguing over this week's cause du jour of autism.
And tell us about the book, Neurotribes. Where do you get it? I assume Amazon has it?
Yeah, it goes on sale tomorrow. That's
perfect timing.
Tonight. It's tonight. I'm in California, so it's tomorrow. You know, it's 40 minutes for me or whatever. But, yeah, it goes on sale tomorrow. I've been working on it for 5 years. So tomorrow is the big day for me. So I'm really excited.
Good for you. It was dedicated hard work. And I hope you win some awards for this, Steve.
Thank you, buddy. I really appreciate it.
And when you got into this as a science writer, was it easy or difficult for you? We've got about 25 seconds here before the break, but was it a tough research project for you?
Oh, my God. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
I bet it would be.
It was a nightmare, man. It was so difficult. It was unbelievable.
All right, stay with us, Stephen. We're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with you as we talk about your work, Neurotribes. Autism, that's what we're talking about this hour, and a truly amazing story. And like people like Stephen in Syracuse who just have battled their way back and have made it happen for themselves. Good for him. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about Tales of the Bizarre, so make sure you're part of that program on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment here with Steve Silberman as we talk about autism. Steve, let's go right to the calls as they continue to line up for you. Robert in Las Vegas. Hey, Robert, go ahead, sir.
George, you have a great, you're just a great guy. I'd like to see you as a presidential candidate. You raise more issues than any candidate. You probably could win. So I appreciate what you do just for all of us. I want to just say that. Thank you very much from
Thank
my
you.
Heart. Respectively, I'm an independent researcher for 20 years. I'm disappointed, respectively, I'd like to say, with the guest and the interview. While he may have a selective niche market for the book, he's really offering no hope for reversing or preventing autism, and it's mostly a history book. And this is why your critical health guests like Joel Wallach that address certain nutritional deficiencies and toxicities are very popular. And to say that, you know, you mentioned vaccines, and I know nobody really wants to say 100% attribution, but to rule out and say vaccines have no risk or link is completely unscientific, considering that you have toxic preservatives like mercury, aluminum, formaldehyde. He doesn't mention that. I think also there's other modalities that have been known. And in my research, I've uncovered that you know, most of these vaccines are given to infants and babies, and babies are born with a sterile gut flora. They essentially have no probiotics in their gut, and gut flora plays a key response, a key role in immune function. And so babies are given these multiple doses of vaccines, and they have negative immune responses when somebody older, an older adult, would not react that way. There's so much anecdotal testimonies that show that normal children come in, get a vaccine, and have an adverse reaction, and they're never the same. Just that one statement by your guest has really thrown me off. I think you need to go back, reevaluate the data, talk about what are some treatment modalities. Do stem cells play a role? What about reversing toxicity? How about an organic vaccine? It doesn't have any of these toxic chemicals. I mean, that right there would eliminate probably 90% of the controversy, because most people are not against vaccines. They're against a lot of the contaminants. And it turns out a lot of these vaccines have polyvinyl chloride derivatives in them, plastic. That's been recently on the news. There's BPA in there. So there's a lot of things, I think. I'm really disappointed in the interview. Coast to coast, we really expect something like Wallach and the other pharmacists you have. So, George, thanks for everything you do. You're a great person. I got to say, you're in my prayers. Thank you for what you do for us.
All right, Stephen, we'll let you react to that. Robert, thank you for your comments.
Yeah, I don't need to react because, your caller knows exactly what he thinks, and, you know, that's his business. It's fine. I just don't share his beliefs, but it's cool. Yes, I was, you know, that's what I'm writing, A History of Autism. That's what it is.
Well, and I got to tell you, it's important for people to have other views. So, you know,
absolutely.
His views, I mean, that's
I'm
healthy.
I'm all for it. No, that's what that's what the show is about, is being open-minded. So,
I'm sure as a researcher, both of you take things with each other that you pick up, that you learn. I've learned more about autism tonight talking to you than I've learned all my life.
The thing. I am sure that your caller and I share one thing, which is that we both want life to be better for autistic people and their families.
Yep.
And so we each have our own different ways of getting there. That's fine. But we both want the same thing.
Maybe one day we'll find that common denominator where everybody who's been on both sides kind of meet in the middle. First time, let's go to Martha, Pleasant View, Utah. Martha, thanks for holding so long. Go ahead. I think you were. Martha? Martha? Nope. I heard her breathing, though. Didn't you hear her breathing there, Steve? she fell asleep with the phone on her chest or something. That happens a lot. Let's go to Derek in Riverside, California. Hi, Derek. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing? Thanks for having
good.
Me.
Good.
Mr. Silverman, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Derek?
I'm all right. I have a question. I have a son, 7 years old. This is his mom. When I met her, she had a daughter that was probably 7 or 8. And this was my first time, like, around. You know, I didn't say it was wrong with her, but she was, you know, she said that she was fragile, autistic, but a form of Fragile X. Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Fragile X is it's a subset of autism that's caused by a known mutation. So
right.
It's pretty rare, but in that case, they know exactly what causes it, yeah.
Right. It was like, she said it was like a male mutation through her family, and I was, you know, okay, that's weird. And I didn't have any children, but we ended up having, well, even before we had children, you know, I thought, there's any chance? She said, no, not really. And, you know, when he was born, he wasn't breathing right, and I knew it. But besides that, he's 7 now, and he still doesn't speak. He can't use the bathroom on his own. He wears diapers. You know, so I was just wondering as far as a gene, or it's not. So I was just kind of wondering about that, because obviously we were not together, or we broke up shortly after he was born. So I kind of done my own and then heard it from her and did this. So I was just wondering what your thoughts on that were. And I'll take your comments off here.
you know, it's rough. And basically, you know, one thing that I hope that my book does is start a social dialogue that we need to help parents like you more and kids like your son more than we're doing. So, you know, instead of spending $50 million on a genetic study, that we make some of that money available for families and autistic people, because basically every autism parent, unless they're unbelievably wealthy, is really in a tough spot. There are never enough resources available. And I think that that's what we really need to be focusing on as a country. And in fact, you know, England in some ways is doing better than we are, because England provides a lot of services for adults. They spend like 2/3 of the money that the National Autistic Society spends is on, you know, helping adults live better lives. And that's a good model for us, actually.
In terms of research, what are we doing worldwide to try to get to the bottom of this?
Well, you know, as I say, a lot of the research now is focused on risk factors, you know, prenatal risk factors for autism. And, you know, I understand the argument for that. However, I do think that much more research needs to be done, particularly, like, we don't even know how many autistic adults there are in America. And what's so interesting is that in England, they did a study where they went out looking for undiagnosed autistic adults living in the community. And what they found was that it was about 1 in 100 people, which is exactly what the estimate of kids, autistic kids in England was at the time when they did the study. So that would suggest that even though, you know, we're constantly talking here about the numbers going up, it would suggest that the number has actually been stable, but that older autistic people were not able to get diagnoses before. And so I think we have to get back to some really basic science about autism and look at, for instance, how many autistic adults are there out there? Are they living successful lives? If so, what can we learn from their lives? Are they working? Are they taking care of themselves? What is their health like? What health problems do they struggle with? There's a lot that we could learn from autistic adults. And because we not only don't study them, the Government Accountability Office in June reported that research on autistic adults has actually gone down in the last few years. And that's exactly the wrong direction. We have to be looking at what helps autistic people's lives work so we can help the families that are in such desperate straits.
And I'm wondering if stem cells would work. Robert brought up something interesting.
I mean, it's been tried. It hasn't worked yet. You know, but that's one of the, you know, I mean, there have been a million, you know, treatments, and nothing has worked yet. I mean, the one thing that does work is having parents who believe in the kid and having teachers who believe in the kid's potential and having communities that support the kid rather than, you know, stigmatizing and bullying. Those things definitely work. You know, maybe stem cells will also work, but giving, you know, supporting autistic people and their families always works. So that's what I'm in favor of.
Mayette is in New York and now on Coast to Coast. Hello, Mayette. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi.
Steve, let me mention that one of the things with autism is that there's repetitive, compulsive, and loss of impulse control. I want to wonder why you didn't drill down into the vaccine issue. And I want to give some examples why I think it's important. The Amish don't get any vaccines, and they have zero to know autism in their families. Early on, there used to be 1 to about 66,000 that were diagnosed or had those very bizarre symptoms and non-functioning of autism, and now it's about 1 in 60-something. I also would like to know if you're familiar with Dr. Thompson, who recently, as a CDC whistleblower, he came out with a study that actually hid the fact that African-American boys who got certain vaccines, maybe it's the combo one, MMR, had, you know, much higher rates of having autism. And I'd also like you to, I'd also like to know if you're familiar with Andrew Wakefield, who was brought down but has since been rehabilitated, who did studies about the dangers of giving, in particular, the combo vaccine and how the gut flora changes and how that's tied to autism. And if you have my questions and my concerns, I'll listen over the air.
All right, Maya, do you want to comment on some of those, Stephen?
Well, you know, vaccines were not what I was writing about. However, I will tell you that even for people who are absolutely convinced that Andrew Wakefield was right and that vaccines cause autism, they will learn very, very interesting things about the history of autism and how the diagnosis has completely changed in the last 35 years that will help them understand what's going on.
Do you think it would be worth it and worthwhile to do some extensive scientific studies on vaccines and autism?
Well, there have been some, and, you know, for instance, a lot of parents blamed a vaccine addition called thimerosal, and when thimerosal was taken out of vaccines in Japan, it did not affect the rate of increase in the diagnosis. So, you know, there have been studies done on that. People, you know, like to say, oh, why don't they do studies? But actually, there have been many studies. But, I mean, the one thing you can't do is give a study where you intentionally deny kids a vaccine, because if the kids got sick, obviously there would be huge liability issues. But, you know, there have been studies of unvaccinated populations. The thing about the Amish, you know, that's often repeated on the Internet, that the Amish don't get autism. However, there have actually been studies of autistic people in Amish communities. So it actually does happen. So, you know, we can respectfully disagree, but even people who are convinced that vaccines cause autism need to know the stuff that I wrote about in my book, because it's very, very interesting.
Well, and that's important to point out, too.
Yeah.
It is. I've always wondered about vaccines, though, that those proponents of vaccines, why they push people who don't want them, when my thoughts are, if you got your vaccine, you're not going to come down with the disease, so don't worry about it. Larry in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Larry, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, George, so much. I've been an insider about 6 years now and wouldn't miss it for the world.
Thank you.
And you got another great one here. I have two developmentally disabled brothers. One of them is autistic, John. And just to back up what you said, Steve, my parents, too, he was born in the early 70s. And they, too, were told that it was their fault and to put him away. And they did for about 6 weeks, and my father just couldn't believe what he saw there and sat down with my mom and said that I can't believe that God gave us this child to give him away. And they took him home, brought him back home, and went through a lot of very difficult self-abusive behavior, disgusting behaviors, violent. When he hit about six, he had a miraculous turnaround. And John's obsession is time zones. As a matter of fact, I grew up in Western New York, and he's down in Nashville visiting me right now for my birthday. And he is walking into stores to look at clocks just to make sure we're in Central Time. And he's extremely social. He's extremely compassionate. And I can't imagine growing up without him. I learned... You know, our whole family had learned unconditional love, learned patience, and learned kindness and all kinds of good things because of it. And real quick, just one of his dreams, my brother's dreams is to get on a plane and go to every time zone, get off the plane, look at the clock, and end up in Alaska, where he can stay and visit for a while. So
we gotta make that happen, Larry.
Yep, and your parents are brave pioneers, man. That is wonderful that you know they took him home and dealt with everything that they had to deal with, but he ended up being a blessing and a gift to the family. So that is a wonderful story.
How many families, Steve, stick it out with the child who is autistic?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot more families than used to. A lot of autistic kids are raised at home or with help, or, you know, perhaps they live in group homes in the community. But, you know, one thing that I thought was very interesting that I discovered while writing the book, one of the chapters of my book is about Rain Man and the real-life autistic kids who provided the model for Dustin Hoffman's character of Raymond Babbitt. What's so interesting is that at the end of that movie, Raymond Babbitt has to go back in the institution because he's unable to survive in the outside world. But the interesting truth is that none of the kids that that character was based on were in an institution. They had all been raised at home by their parents. And their parents were really pioneering, you know, figuring out ways of taking care of autistic kids at home. And they, you know, the kids did much better, like Temple Grandin, who I mentioned before. The kids did much better because they weren't put in institutions. And so that turned out to be the future.
Well, I'm glad we brought this to the forefront. Stephen, thanks so much. Good luck with the book. That's just coming out right now, NeuroTribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Up next, Tales of the Bizarre. Hold on. We'll be back.